this edition of the Hagmann and Hagmann Report. What a treat, what an honor it is to be talking with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com. It's linked off of HagmannReport.com, as well as it's in the program description and across all of our venues, Globalstar, BTR, as well as YouTube. But folks, go to CorbettReport.com and become a member. Donate to his research. If you look at the totality of his research, of Mr. Corbett's research, you'll find just a tremendous and informative research product. And what a great asset he is. Before we get back to Mr. Corbett, I'm going to address, this is to all of the business owners out there. Let me ask you, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates for that position you might have open? Well, folks, posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. No. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your jobs across all venues, on all the top job sites, and now you can. Here's what we use. We use, and we've tried it out, it's worked wonders, ZipRecruiter.com. There you can post your job at 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city, in any industry, nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And if I can use it, anyone can use it. No juggling of emails, no calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by many Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small business and medium-sized businesses. Right now, folks, and this is the great part, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
And we were talking with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, Corbett Report on YouTube. Before the break, we were talking about Obama. You have a post on your website and on YouTube, A Legacy of Ashes. And before the break, you were talking about how it wasn't that Obama was evil, that it was what he, his ideology, what he believed is evil. And you talked about the control behind the Citibank picking his cabinet positions. How much of the Obama administration decisions were his own versus how many do you think were made for him already?
That's a very good question. I would imagine very few of them were Obama's own. And I think the vast majority of them came from those that he was connected to and connected with. And there are, I think, in any administration, there are centers of power, and I think that varies from administration to administration. I think it's quite obvious in the Bush era that it was not George W. Bush running the country. If anything, it was his vice president, Dick Cheney, who had much more control over that administration. In the same way, I think in the Reagan era, it was not that power was very much in the presidential office. It was in the vice presidential office of George H.W. Bush. And he was running things like Iran-Contra. And I'm sure Reagan really wasn't involved in the nitty-gritty of that. I'm pretty sure he didn't get his fingers dirty in all of that. I think that was George H.W. Bush running that. So in the Obama era, I think the history is still yet to be written and parsed. But I would imagine that it's more in places like when Secretary of State Clinton was in the State Department. I'm sure that she had a lot of control over shaping the policy in Libya, for example, in Syria in its early stages. Or, for example, Victoria Nuland in the State Department helping to puppeteer what the Maidan coup in the Ukraine, bringing the fascists into power there. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to uncover who was behind which particular policies and in what way they were advocated. But the idea that Obama was ruling over all of this, I think, is the most naive view of all. And I think the point really in creating, especially, I mean, of course, we're looking back at the Obama era because it's the end of the Obama era, so we need to understand that legacy. But I think, as always, the history is what's important. Can we learn from that for today? And it's important to look back at the crowds from 2008. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Chanting in hypnotic union at the rapture of this Messiah that was being called a Messiah and Superman, and he came from Krypton and all of this kind of nonsense that was floating around in the atmosphere at that time, to see how powerful a delusion, hope, and change can be, and how powerfully he tapped into that with his campaign slogans and all of that. The iconography was there to make him into something that he was not, this Messiah that was going to save people. And now I see it happening from the opposite perspective. I see it happening with Trump and people investing their identity in Trump. I get it. He says things that appeal to people and things that are good and things that go against the globalists. And look, the CIA is attacking him, all of this. Therefore, it means he's good. I just hope that people can look at the way that delusion has worked in the past and understand that it still has an effect on people today. And to use that to at least, I mean, hey, don't believe James Corbett. Who is he? He's a nobody in Japan. What does he know about American politics? Fine, don't believe me. But just reserve a tiny place in your heart that you do not give over to identifying in the rapture of this new political messiah. Just reserve a tiny little bit of skepticism, a place for you to at least stand apart from that, so that you don't give your identity over to it. Because once you do that, then you go along with anything that comes along. And I think if you fall for anything, you'll stand for nothing. And I think that's the exact opposite of the place we want to be in.
I think you're exactly right. I believe everybody needs to have a healthy skepticism of any administration, since we've seen throughout history how the president, the office of the president, is used to continue to further the globalist and New World Order agenda. And there's no reason to believe that it has been stopped dead in its tracks right now. I just believe that there's areas that Trump will be able to come out and harp on against. But at the same time, like you mentioned with the Federal Reserve, there will be areas that are under the radar behind the scenes that they will, you know, move 10 steps forward with. And then when they get their other person in place, or if they need to, then they can go back and work on the things that they couldn't do right now. Which brings me to our next point. We have two issues going on right now. The executive order Trump signed to get the U.S. out of the TPP, and what that means to countries on the Pacific Rim, Asia-Pacific Rim, and U.S.-China relations under Trump and the threat of war. If we can, let's start with the TPP.
Yes, a very interesting move, and obviously one that I think is for the best, because the TPP was a monstrosity crafted and created behind closed doors in unprecedented secrecy. Not just secrecy, but total secrecy, to the point where even congressmen could not look at the bill as it was being drafted and negotiated. They had to go into a secret room in the bowels of the Congress, and, you know, they couldn't even take a notepad with them and all of this kind of nonsense. Let alone the secrecy that was surrounding all of the different negotiation meetings, where they had, you know, helicopters and people with guns on the roof and all of this, trying to make sure that nobody penetrated the secrecy of this agreement. And then when it was finally released, of course, it was hundreds and hundreds of pages of total nonsense, legalese, gibberish. But if you could sort your way through even a few of the clauses, you would see that it was, again, a complete monstrosity that was created by and for the corporate oligarchs to maintain their essentially monopolistic control over international trade. A free trade policy could be written on the back of a cocktail napkin. No, you don't put tariffs on our goods. We won't put tariffs on yours. There you go. But no, of course, that's not what this is. It's about exceptionally controlled trade so that only the crony oligarchs could get involved in it. So scrapping the TPP is a great thing, I think, ultimately. But it's interesting to see the way that this will play out and what will happen as a result of the vacuum that's been created. Last December, just last month, the Japanese parliament, the Diet, actually ratified the TPP, which is extremely odd because with the U.S. out, it is a dead agreement. The TPP, as written, has to be ratified by all members, including, of course, the United States. So it is officially dead now that they're pulling out. But Japan ratified it anyway, which is odd, unless we see that as a portent of things to come. Perhaps the creation of an alternate TPP without the U.S. All right, they won't join it. Well, who will? And guess who's stepping into the void? China. In November, Zero Hedge was reporting, with TPP dead, China officially launches its own Pacific free trade deal. So the ultimate effect of this might be, if this really is an America First administration and they really do step away from these types of agreements, well, someone's going to fill in that void in terms of the power relations in the Asia Pacific, and it's probably going to be China. And although that would have seemed almost unthinkable even a few years ago when there was active and open squabbles going on in, for example, the South China Sea, where, of course, there's still territorial disputes and what have you. But now we have the president, the new president of the Philippines, Duterte, is saying that China is the better, you know, they want to partner up with China and, you know, to hell with the U.S. and all this kind of rhetoric that's coming from Duterte. And then also we have even Australia saying, well, look, I mean, our interests are more served with going with China. And you have important people in the Australian governments starting to talk that way. So there really is a change that's taking place here. Barring some sort of drastic move, I don't think it'll happen overnight. But still, I think we're going to see China stepping up more and more. And that will be a very interesting transition to make. As unfortunately, as I've also documented, I did a podcast on China and the New World Order that showed that the rise of China over the last 15, 20 years as an economic powerhouse did not happen out of the blue or naturally or spontaneously. It's been a coordinated effort over the last four decades by the Rockefellers and their ilk, Kissinger yep. and Brzezinski and all of them, to try to make China into this superpower. So I don't think they're free from all of this game anyway, but at any rate, it'll be a different looking Asia Pacific.
Yeah, and you mentioned the rise of China. Kissinger, Brzezinski, and so many others. Rockefeller wrote about the rise of Asia and the Asian markets decades ago, and how you know, the U.S., with their superpower being the only superpower after the 90s, it was time to, they didn't come out and just say create a new enemy, but they talked about, you know, the emerging Asian market and how it could be better served for their interests here if they built that up to have another strong economy. And we just saw at the World Economic Summit, just a few weeks back, the president of China talked about, you know, if Trump's going to continue to do the America First thing, the nationalist thing, that he would step up and his country would step up to fill the globalist role, if you will. And apparently following suit with, you know, seeing these countries and China step up and say, we'll take the TPP agreement or a similar agreement. If we can, let's talk about the, and you mentioned the China U.S. relations. You know, Trump came out today, and we've seen this big dust up over the islands.
The one China policy.
Yeah, there's a few things that the China and the U.S. seem to be butting heads on. It seemed to be starting in the Obama administration, and now with Trump, you see the Chinese government ban the inauguration streams. You know, you couldn't talk about the inauguration, you couldn't stream the inauguration. Many said it was because they weren't sure where Trump is and how U.S.-China relations would continue. Do you expect conflict, military conflict, between the U.S. and China over some of the things that we seem to be butting heads over right now?
Right. Maybe it's wishful thinking of a sort on my part, but I don't see military confrontation as being what is ultimately what would be best for these powers that shouldn't be and what they want anyway. I think what they want, from everything that I can see from the outside, it looks like they're trying to set up the 21st century equivalent of the Cold War, the 20th century Cold War. And in that context, just like the Soviet Union was largely a paper tiger built up by lend lease and technology transfers and other things that facilitated and made the Soviet Union what it was, came from the West, and that's been amply documented by Anthony Sutton and other researchers. I think in the same way, we have to see China in that context. It's a largely paper dragon that's been constructed by the West to fill that boogeyman role in a lot of different ways. So I think that seems to me the direction they want to take this in, which means that I don't think they are looking to actually go into hot military conflict. And even if they did, I mean, China is certainly growing in terms of its capabilities, but it's still, if it came to outright open naval warfare, there's no chance they would stand of more than a batting of an eyelid against the U.S. Navy at this point. So I don't think that serves anyone's interests. The growing tension, however, serves everyone's interests. It rallies all of the domestic populations around the flags, and it creates the never-ending need for more and more of the toys for big boys that the military contractors are more than happy to provide at the cost of billions and billions of dollars. So we've seen, for example, military expenditures in the Asia-Pacific region increasing in recent years, and no sign that that trend's going to die down in the Trump era. So I think you're right to pick up on the rising tensions. I think that to honestly, I think that is going to be one of the, I think that's where they want to try to take the Trump administration. All this Russian boogeyman stuff is craziness and easily demonstrable propaganda. And I think will be brushed under the rug in the coming months. But I think the coming along to take that place will be the Chinese boogeyman. And we see that in terms of course, Trump accepting the phone call from the president of Taiwan, breaking decades of diplomatic protocol, breaking the U.S. agreement on one China policy that everyone says, okay, there's one China. We just won't say, you know, what that means and who controls it, but we'll just, it's one China and we won't rock that boat. Well, it looks like Trump is getting ready to rock that boat. And as you say, there's also disputes in the South China Sea in terms of islands, man-made artificial islands that China has constructed and is ready to militarize, that Rex Tillerson in his confirmation hearings for Secretary of State, which he incidentally has just been approved for, he mentioned the idea that they will block access to those islands to China, which means a naval blockade, which means outright military confrontation. So either he was misspeaking or was speaking off the cuff in the fifth hour of rather grueling testimony, or they are really truly talking about going into hot naval warfare. Again, I don't think that's where that would serve anyone's interests at this point. So I'm not looking at that as the imminent possibility, but trade warfare certainly is a possibility. And it'll be interesting to see the way this plays out, because as I say, Kissinger clearly meeting with Trump, clearly has the president's ear. Kissinger, also the person who literally wrote the book on China and about China's role in the New World Order and all of this, and his intimate part in helping construct that as a Rockefeller minion. It's getting crazy, but I think that clearly we can see that China is going to step into that boogeyman role, whether they like it or not.
That's very well put, and a great breakdown of what's happening. And I agree that, you know, the boogeyman aspect of China, the one part that concerns me, and I want to ask you if you had to guess or make a prediction here. Do you see, we talked about the possibility for the U.S. economy to collapse and the American currency being taken off as the world reserve currency. Is that more plausible than a war with China, is to see the switch from America as a world reserve currency if there was an economic situation, transfer that to China? I guess the question is, if America were to fall as a world reserve currency, would China be the one to pick that up?
I think it would be a multilateral move rather than a unilateral move. And I think China is specifically positioned itself for that. For the last 8 years now, the Chinese, the People's Bank of China governor has been openly advocating for the IMF's special drawing rights to become the world reserve currency. And people have probably heard about the SDR, at least in passing, but it is essentially, it's not a currency per se. It's a type of claim on currency that central banks can use. Instead of holding dollars in their reserve accounts, they can hold these SDRs, and they can redeem them in any of previously four, now five currencies. It was the US dollar and the euro and the yen and whichever one I'm forgetting off the top of my head. Major world currency, the British pound, of course. And just last October, the Chinese yuan was added to that basket. After years of trying to campaign to get added to the basket, they were finally added to that basket. So now China has a seat at the table, as it were. And that's the thing that bugs me most about this, because there are people who look at, China and Russia as these bulwarks against the NATO powers, and they're fighting against these globalists. Well, in a sense, but what are they fighting for? And when you look at it, it's always they're fighting for, well, we want to see that the IMF table, or we want to create this alternate to the World Bank IMF system, and it'll be this, you know, this BRICS, or it will be the new BRICS Bank, or the Asian Development, or the AIIB, or these types of things. And they're always run by people who are sometimes literally ex-IMF or ex-World Bank members. It's always the same people, and they're always trying to create these multilateral institutions that are basically just mirror images of the ones they're trying to replace and fighting against. So that no matter which side of the phony dialectic you're on, you're still going to get multilateral regional government of some sort or other. And I think that's the logic of this. So when and if the U.S. dollar does lose its reserve currency status, world reserve currency, it will be replaced more than likely by a type of basket currency that's overseen by an institution like the IMF, which isn't, I mean, it's certainly no better for the average person. It's just going to be a different system of multilateral control. In fact, in some ways, even more distant from the average American, because at least you have some theoretical kind of interaction with the American government. What interaction do you have with the IMF? What role do you say over, you know, what will happen with the pound or the yen or the euro? It just becomes this completely diffuse thing, which of course is tightly managed and controlled by very, very few people over whom you have no control. So it's getting crazier, but people are walking into it because it seems like, oh, they're fighting against the NATO and U.S., you know, American Empire kind of system, and I think it's just a false dialectic.
Yeah, it's what you said about how they, what are they fighting against, what are they fighting for? It's interesting to look and see, you know, like you said, the mirror images of each other, almost like they want the same future that we have, and that's where they seem to want to go. On your website, and again, folks, Corbett Report. I'm sorry.
See, you did that again.
I apologize.
James, we were doing that all day, and we apologize.
Yeah. Interview 1245, you talk about the India demonetization disaster. This is something we talked about on our show here, about how they went about banning cash in India and how that was originated in Washington, D.C. And will that, or something like that, a cashless society happen here in the U.S.? Can you explain to us what's going on in India now?
Very insightful, yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, to be clear, it's not a ban on cash per se. What they did was they took the 500 rupee note and the 1,000 rupee note, and they said, as of midnight tonight, on the night that they announced this, it's going to be no longer legal tender. Over the next couple of months, you'll have a couple of months grace period to cash in your old notes and get new ones. So they've issued, and they're printing new currency to replace that, those old notes. And the idea here is, probably much like in the United States and elsewhere, people keep a certain amount of cash that is off the table and they use it for their informal economy, black market, whatever you want to call it, which is a substantial part of the Indian economy, because of course a lot of people are some of the poorest people on the planet who don't use banks and aren't a part of the banking system. All of this money is not purview to the government and the taxation and all of this. So they've made this big stink about black money in the Indian economy, as they call it, which is basically just untaxed money. And so in order to combat this problem and all of the corruption that comes with it, well, let's do this, and we'll call in all the notes. So everyone has to go to the bank and trade it in for new notes. So now the government knows under your name that you have this much money. And so that's what this was about. And this is important. 500 and 1,000 rupee notes make up something like 80% of the value of cash in the Indian economy. And the Indian economy is something like 97-98% cash-based. So it's a substantial amount of the Indian economy is going to have to travel through the banks over the coming months, and has created a lot of chaos already, will continue to create chaos. Where this is going is, I think, towards facilitating, if not a completely cashless society, at least kick-starting putting it into hyperspeed, the process of putting India into a more cashless system, cashless payment system. And you mentioned Washington's role in this. Norbert Herring has a great article on this, a well-kept open secret. Washington is behind India's brutal experiment of abolishing most cash, where he points out that just 4 weeks before this surprise announcement came, by the way, 500 to 1,000 rupee notes are no longer legal tender, U.S. aid established with the Indian Finance Ministry something called Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership, in which they wanted to basically throw into hyper gear this transfer into a cashless payment system economy. And the CEO, for example, says, Catalyst's mission is to solve multiple coordination problems that have blocked the penetration of digital payments among merchants and low-income consumers. We look forward to creating a sustainable and replicable model and a holistic ecosystem approach, and all of this kind of nonsense, feel-good, fuzzy propaganda words that they love to throw around, which is basically just the U.S. aid helping the Indian government to go towards cashless payment systems. And I think India is once again being used, especially the poorest people in India are being used as a type of test subject. Can we transition people from completely cash-based into completely cashless? Can we do that? How do we do that? How do we get people in that? And I think again, that program being announced 4 weeks before they start this demonetization campaign has to be significant and has to be viewed from that lens. And I do have a report up on my website called The War on Cash. I can't remember what it's called. Just type War on Cash into my search bar and you'll find it. And it's myself and the members of the Corporate Report community have assembled dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of stories from all around the world, literally dozens of countries, about different cashless payment systems and cashless ideas that are being promoted by various governments literally all around the world, in every nook and cranny of the world right now. Governments are advocating for cashless payments because ultimately this is the crowning jewel in the hands of the powers that shouldn't be. The idea of complete control over the economy and micromanaging and having access to everything that goes on in that economy depends on being some sort of electronic payment system that can be monitored and controlled from a central place. And that's the economy that they want to steer us into. And it's only a question of how quickly they can do so and how best to engineer society to accept it once it comes. It's very worrying. It should be very worrying to everyone, but I think a lot of people are perhaps asleep at the switch on this issue and don't understand why it's so important. So I'm putting together a podcast right now that'll be hopefully released on my website at the end of this week, talking about India's demonetization and what it means for people around the world.
Fantastic. James Corbett, I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us tonight. Folks, go to CorbettReport.com, Corbett Report on YouTube, and bookmark his site. Help him out. Support what he's doing. He's a fantastic
Become
journalist.
A member, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
James, thank you so much. You have a great evening. Great day.
Thank you for having me on.
Anytime.
No questions, sir.
When we come back, Raymond Ibram. His website is RaymondIbram.com. He is an author and a Middle East and Islamic specialist. We'll be right back.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for your belief and your trust in us. Well, I'll tell you, we've got a very, very special guest with us this hour, Raymond Ibram. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him. I'm sure you have, unless you've been living under a rock, in which case you haven't. But Raymond Ibram is just a prolific author. He is a specialist, really, in Middle Eastern affairs. You know, I'm going to let him tell you about himself as opposed to me telling you. But he's got a couple of books, such as Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. That was back in 2013. And it's still relevant, even more so today. And The Al-Qaeda Reader, back in 2007. And his writings and translations and observations have appeared in many, many venues, New York Times and CNN, LA Times, and I can go on and on and on, but very widely published and very well known. Joe, I'm going to kick it over to you to bring him on.
Yeah, again, Raymond Ibram is our guest. Raymond, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Great to have you. You're the author of a few books, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, that was released in 2013, and The Al-Qaeda Reader, and you've been showcased on a number of publications. It would take me probably the rest of the segment to read through them. Where do you want to start tonight? We have a lot going on between with Syria, with Iran, a lot of rhetoric, you know, coming out of the administration that they're going to eviscerate the Islamic terrorism, something we have not seen talked about in the Obama administration. And at the same time, you know, all the drone strikes. There's so much going on between with Islam and the nations in the Middle East and tension due to terrorism. Where do you want to start?
You know, I usually like to start off with a little history to show us and to bring us up to speed, because I think a lot of people think that the issues that you just touched upon, amongst many others, are, you know, I mean, they're definitely the issues, but people think that it all starts there, or maybe it goes back just a little bit. In fact, so I like to start from the beginning in order that we have the most comprehensive understanding of what we're dealing with. So really, the story starts about almost 1,400 years ago when a caravan trader named Muhammad reportedly got a message from Alma. And of course, I'm not going to go into that whole long story, but the point here is that, and, you know, I can actually connect this to something else I'm doing. You were mentioning what I'm doing in the books I've written. The current book that I'm actually working on is a military history between Islam and Christendom. And then, of course, after a while, Christendom becomes what we call the West. And what's so eye-opening to me, and this is the reason I want to, I'm writing this book, I want to bring it out, is to show you all the many parallels of all the things that you're seeing today, whether it's ISIS or, you know, Al-Qaeda or Muslim mobs, Muslim rapists in Europe, Muslim persecution of Christians, the bombing of churches, all this sort of thing has a 1,400-year pedigree, very well documented. And it's, and so this is what I'm actually working on right now, this book, to bring it up and to show it to you. So this is what I mean by history. And, you know, before we go further, we need to remember that this, the conflicts that we're dealing with right now, these don't start recently. These aren't a product of grievances, as we've often been told. They're not a product of the creation of Israel. They're not a product of the war in Iraq, etc. They're not a product because someone drew a cartoon about Muhammad. They go back for 1,400 years. They were unprovoked. They are based 100% on a religious worldview that makes the other, the non-Muslim, the so-called infidel, a hated enemy who has to, when Muslims can, and that's another missing ingredient, when Muslims can, they are supposed to go on the offensive and do all this sorts of thing, which is what the history book is about. You see mass movements. It's not just a terrorist group. It's not just underground funding for terrorists or, you know, under or secretive clandestine activities. It was mass movements back then. You're not seeing that so much now, of course, because most Muslim nations are, can't do that sort of thing. And so that's just a preface to what we'll be talking about, to keep in mind that this is a long and old story that is still ongoing. And while we see different manifestations in the current events, it's the same exact animus that animated the Muslims of the olden times. It's the same one that's animating their descendants right now.
Okay. And thanks for that contextual background. We really appreciate that. And, yeah, and the history that you, the foundation that you laid. Most people, at least here, from my experience, their first experience exposure to Islam was on 9/11. And even though, of course, you know, we've seen the we saw the rise of Islam throughout the 20th century, but another 21st or 20th century. But nonetheless, my question to you is this simple, very simple question: based on your experience, your knowledge, is Islam, I'm going to come right and ask you, is Islam compatible with our representative republic? I'll just throw that question out there. Can Muslims coexist here in the United States, advocating Sharia law, and coexist here in the U.S.?
Islamic Sharia law is 100% antithetical to the U.S. Constitution and other forms of liberal democracies and so forth. You have to understand Islamic Sharia, first of all, the word Sharia, which has become very popular in recent times, what it ultimately means is it means the way, the road. And so in Arabic, if I was to say the street, if I'm walking on the street, excuse me, it's called Shara, and it comes from Sharia, okay? So the Sharia is this thing that Muslims derive from their sacred scriptures, primarily the Quran, and what's called the Hadith, which basically records and documents the words and deeds of Muhammad, who in Islam is considered the most perfect man. You're supposed to emulate him. That's where we get the word Sunnah. That's another important word. You hear of Sunnis and Shias. Sunnis, who make up for about 90% of the Muslim world, what their name signifies is they are the ones who are trying to pattern their lives after Muhammad's words and deeds. So you have these two sources, the Quran and the Sunnah of Muhammad. And if you look at what the Quran teaches, and especially what the Sunnah, or the example of the Prophet, shows, you will find any number of things that are 100% contradictory to the U.S. Constitution. There is no religious freedom. If you're born to a Muslim father, you are, and you try to leave the religion, you either become an atheist, or if you want to convert to Christianity or whatever, if you try to break away, especially openly, you can be executed. And that's actually, that traces to the words of Muhammad himself, who said verbatim, whoever tries to leave the religion, kill him. You cannot have freedom of worship. Churches, as you probably know, all around the Islamic world are banned, are bombed, are burned in places where they're not fully banned or where you have tolerant governments. Women are essentially chattel compared to men. There is no sexual equality whatsoever. You know, you can go on and on with these things. Now, the problem is, as I pointed out, these are derived from the Quran, which is Muslims believe to be the absolute literal verbatim word of Allah, much more so than most Christians see the Bible. Christians will tell you the Bible is inspired. It is the word of God, but it's inspired, written by men, etc. To Muslims, no, every alphabet, every word written in the Quran is verbatim, literal, you have to accept it, and so forth. And they all teach things that just are not compatible with what we're talking about. And so, of course, to answer your question, that's a lengthy way to give it to you, but the long and short of it is no, 100% not.
Okay. Yeah, and I think everyone really understands that. We've got what I believe is one of the most educated and well-versed audiences in the world, but I just want to get a couple of foundational points, or wanted to get that foundation set. Here we are in 2017, engaged in what I see as a battle that, well, on your website, and folks, you can go to RaymondIbrahim.com. It's linked on our program description, but it's also linked on HagmanReport.com. You wrote a very interesting article, "Sees Saudi Oil Solve World Problems." We're going to get into that in a second, but before we get into that itself, I want to ask you something a little bit, to preface that, and kind of work backwards from present day. The Obama regime, I don't even want to call it an administration, but we saw, to me anyway, what I saw was this great mass infiltration of Muslims, of the Muslim agenda into our system, our society, our government, various departments within our government. How hobbled have we become, and how subjugated have we become to the Muslim agenda through Obama and his predecessor, George W. Bush?
Very much so. And, you know, this goes to an important point that I often try to make, which is, in as much as the Muslim world, and especially Islamic doctrines, the sort that I've touched upon before, are intrinsically dangerous to us, to the non-Muslim world, you have to remember and keep in mind, in contrast to that historical, that long epic of history, the millennial history that I was referring to, of Muslims invading Europe, taking over lands, and so forth, the animus still exists today within the Islamic world, but what's missing is the capacity. The Islamic world, as of today, is a very weak entity. In other words, if the West, if just maybe a couple of Western countries, or the USA alone, wanted to, if the West, for instance, had the world view, the hostile world view that Islam teaches, in which dichotomizes the world between us, the believers, and the infidel, the Islamic world would be done for. And so, in the context of what you're saying, is that, yeah, Islam has become a threat precisely because of the policies of people like Obama, and like before him, George W. Bush, and like so many European leaders. They are the ones who enable this terror threat. A simple point of view. We've already examined and discussed some Islamic doctrines. There's a hostility that's ingrained. The common sense, if you looked at Europeans from centuries before, when that ongoing jihad for Europe was going on, they wouldn't allow a Muslim to come and live amongst them, or at least large numbers of them, because they understood what the price was. If you go to Spain, and, you know, we're often reminded it was so terrible, 1492, the eviction of the Muslims and the Jews out of Spain and so forth. And it, of course, it looks so intolerant and, xenophobic from our era. What's missing from that analysis is that those Muslims who were living there were operating against the crown, were operating against Christian society, were trying to subvert it, were helping the Ottomans, for instance, and so forth. And so they concluded the only way is we have to drive them out. And, you know, that may be ugly, but that is history, and that's what people end up doing in order for 100% safety. So when you see, when you know and you hear ISIS, for instance, boasting that it's going to put its infiltrators amongst the refugees, and that they're going to terrorize Europe and or America, and you see it happening, because, sure, not all of those who are coming are terrorists, I don't believe that at all, or even the majority, but you know they're in there. And so if you open the door, they're going to come in amongst them. And then sure enough, we've seen all the terror attacks in Nice, France, all several in Germany, in the United States, Orlando and so forth. San Bernardino, I believe, was one of them, was an immigrant, I believe, from Pakistan. Anyway, so you know there's a hostility, and then you let them in, and then terrorism happens. And so that just shows you it's not that they can do it. Yeah, the animus and the hostility is there. It's the U.S. policies, Western policies, European policies that's empowering them to come and do that. And that's, I think, what a lot of people who may understand what we're talking about and be sympathetic to what we're saying seem to forget. You know, the threat is not that intrinsic at this point. The threat is the first layer of trouble is actually here. It's our own leaders. It's our own policies. They're the ones that enable what is otherwise a very weak Islam to do what it's doing.
And we know that leaders are not stupid. And then that begs the question, why would they allow this? If they really had an allegiance to their own country and to the safety of their own country, what would make them do this
rationale?
Unless they're not allegiance, unless they have no allegiance to this country and they have allegiance to interest at a much higher level, which would then be treason. I guess, why do they do this and how do they get away with it?
Well, the how they get away with it is interesting to me because it's a cultural issue. You know, over the decades, with the concepts of multiculturalism and all these sort of liberal isms that have come into American society and proliferated immensely, you've got a worldview or a mentality amongst your average American now, which is very, you know, tolerant isn't even the word, you know, just very, the idea of what we're talking about, what I'm saying, I'm sure it makes the skin on some people crawl to hear what I'm saying, irrespective of if it's true or not. Because we're taught that all religions are equal, all peoples are the same, and so to come and pinpoint one religion to show it as bad and so forth, this is so, I think, become unintelligible to many people, especially the younger generations, that someone like Obama can come up and despite all the evidence that we're discussing of Islam saying X, Y, and Z, and then Islam doing X, Y, and Z, terrorism on U.S. soil, all he has to do is come out and say, no, you know, it's terrible. That's not who we are. We don't judge people by religion. And most people will immediately acquiesce to that kind of thinking, regardless of how grounded it is in reason and logic. So that's the why they do it. As for how, I think there's, you know, you have various levels of operatives in there. At the great mass, you have what's called the useful idiots, of course. And they're the ones that I was referring to who have, to some degree, become so indoctrinated in this sort of multicultural view that the very idea to say there's something wrong with one particular group of people or religion specifically is anathema to them. But then you have those who I think know exactly what they're doing, and they know, and as you indicated, they are treasonous, but they have their interests, whether it's for money or whatever the case may be, whatever allegiances they have and alliances and whatever, however it works for them. So I think it's a big combination thereof.
All right. If I can ask you a question, and none of this is scripted. Our guest, of course, is Raymond Ibrahim. His website linked off of HagmanReport.com. It's RaymondIbrahim.com. What a fantastic source of knowledge at that location, at that website. But let me ask you a question, sir. Day three, Trump administration, new president, new day, new attitude. If you were put in charge of handling terrorism, of, you know, handling the fight that is being, if you're put in charge of the security of America as it relates to Islamic terrorism, what would you do? What policies would you roll out or suggest to have rolled out, to be rolled out?
Well, the first one would be to essentially, and I'm assuming Trump will do this, revoke essentially what Obama did about 8 years ago, which is he essentially expunged the intelligence community's knowledge of Islam and its inner workings by literally expunging the words Islam and jihad and Sharia from the intelligence manuals for the intelligence community. So that if you are part of the intelligence community and a young cadet who comes in and so forth, ISIS to you is absolutely no different than just a group of criminals. They have no ideological underpinning. Yeah, they may talk about Islam and so forth, but this is not jihad. Jihad, we know, is a wonderful thing. Jihad is about fighting against your own vices and trying to be a good, noble person. That's actually what a lot of people have been fed. So I don't know how pervasive that sort of thing has become in the intelligence community. But for starters, at least bring the truth out, bring the relevant books and the texts and the knowledge out, regardless of how politically incorrect it may be. So that's definitely the first step. As far as the other, you know, it's a large question you're asking. I mean, there's domestic implications, foreign policies that one can pursue. As far as the immediate security of the United States, we definitely have to look into this refugee issue. The thing for me about the refugee, which I've never understood, and it's another capitulation from the West, and or another way that proves that this isn't about, certainly not about a humanitarian crisis. It's about an agenda that, if you want to use the word global elite, the NWO or whatever the case may be, are all working in together, is instead of supposedly the refugees are all pouring out. Why? Because of ISIS. That's the narrative. ISIS has come in, they're terrorizing, they're doing this and that, and so now we've got millions of people migrating. We have to be humanitarian, let them in. Well, as Russian President Putin once said, and I'm in complete agreement with him, he was at the United Nations, he said, the solution isn't to keep opening our doors, the solution is to go take the source out, the source of the problem. And if the problem is ISIS, then why aren't we taking them out? So all these people can go back to their own homes where they actually want to be. True refugees don't want to leave. They actually would prefer to be back in their own homes, the true refugees, not the many ones that are coming in, of course, on a pretext, just because, for whatever purpose, whether it's, just for their own gain or whether they have terrorist inclinations and so forth. So for starters, and I think this is what Trump has said, he's going to essentially obliterate ISIS, so I would definitely push for that. And let's see that happen. And then there goes your refugee crisis, for starters. And while it continues, you know, there's this whole issue. Again, the refugee crisis is supposedly we need to act humanitarian. So I'm all for that. But why don't we actually help those who really are being persecuted? For instance, the Christians of the Middle East. And it's amazing because in reality, if you look at ISIS for whatever it's doing, and of course ISIS will kill other Muslims, especially the wrong kind, Shia, Druze, whatever, but ISIS doesn't go around bombing Sunni mosques. ISIS doesn't go around enslaving Sunni women. It doesn't go around demanding jizya from Sunnis. And it just so happens to be that about 99% of those who have entered into the United States are Sunni Muslims. They're from the same exact sect of ISIS. They're not being persecuted in the sense that, let's say, Christians are. And yet you find that there's a huge, under Obama, a huge disparity between how many Sunni Muslims have come in, 99%, compared to less than 0.5% of Christians from Syria. In Syria, the Christians are at least 10%, and yet only 0.5% of them have been brought in. So the point here is, if you want to be humanitarian, I'm fine for that. Well, why don't we just take the Christians? They're the ones who are actually being slaughtered and being persecuted and being killed. And when they come here, they tend to assimilate because of the common Christian background of the United States. And they tend to be more loyal. How many times Muslims come in and you find out there are moles working in the government, they're trying to subvert. Even in the refugee camps, I was just reading about how Muslim translators are working it so that the few Christian refugees who are, of course, being persecuted in the refugee camps itself, imagine that, refugees who are supposed to feel bad for are persecuting other people just because they're not of their own religion. And the translators are mixing it so that the Christians eventually get kicked out and then sent back to their own nations where they're again attacked. So that's another policy that one can do. If you want to help humans, help the ones. Hungary, in fact, this isn't unprecedented what I'm saying. Hungary is doing that exactly. And I think Poland and Slovenia, they've at least said, let's do that. And I agree with them. So there's some initial ideas.
Yeah, you talked about a number, you mentioned a number of important points. One, the percentage of Christians versus Muslims being brought into the U.S. is completely disproportionate. And you hit those numbers accurately. Very few people really get into those, less than 1% Christian. And then two, the fact that many of the refugees aren't actually refugees by definition, you know, the war-torn areas in Syria, yes, but when you have people coming from all nations, whether there's no conflict, where things are even good in their country, to some degree, coming over, that's not really a refugee. Like you said, refugees are people who would welcome going home, and or assimilating to the culture that they've come into. But you
you talk, we have a few minutes before the break, so I just want to, because this is going to be a long answer, I think. You talk about the hostilities between, and territorial conquest between the Muslims and Christians historically, and you say that most of the Muslim world rests atop conquered Christian territory, and most people are unaware of it, and that there is currently a writing in a new military history book on this theme. Could you get into, if we could go back to the historical roots of the disputes between the Muslim world and the rest of the world, and how we got to where we are today?
Oh, absolutely. That's my specialty. That's my that's what I thrive on. That's what I've been working on lately in this book. And, you know, as you pointed out, how many people understand that in the 7th century when Islam came into being in Arabia, if you took the entire Christian world, Christianity had been around now for over 600 years. It had actually been the religion of the empire for almost for about 300 years, meaning it was widespread and had permeated almost every aspect of the ancient, definitely Roman world. And if you took all that land, the Islamic conquest in the 7th century that spread out ended up seizing more than two-thirds of that land. And so how many people understand that what we today casually refer to as the Muslim world or the Middle East, you know, nations like Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco and Libya and Egypt and Syria and parts of Iraq and, of course, Turkey and so forth, all of that wasn't just Christian. It was actually the original Christian empire. That was where the heart of Christendom was. If you look at the five centers of Christendom, the original apostolic sees, one of them was Rome, and that's the only one that didn't get conquered. Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, Constantinople were all taken by the sword of Islam with a lot of bloodshed. And, you know, yet today we sit around nonchalantly talking about the Muslim world as if it just, you know, happened to come about, spread into that area. That's all stolen land. The indigenous Christians themselves still exist, including, for example, the Copts of Egypt and, you know, the Assyrians, Chaldeans and so forth in Mesopotamia. And they're still being persecuted just like they were. You know, the records that you see of what's happening today and you compare it to what happens as recorded by Muslim historians, same thing. The enslavement, the butchery, the bombing or back then burning of churches and so forth. So I would very much welcome to continue. I know we have a break, but I'd like to continue on this theme very much. But I'd like people to go away with two-thirds of what was once the Christian world was seized by bloodshed from the Islamic world. Some of it was liberated, Spain, for instance, the Balkans from the Ottoman conquests, Greece and so forth, Hungary. They were also conquered territories, and now they got liberated. Even Russia, we forget, Moscow was under the Tatar yoke, which was actually Muslim at that point, and doing the same sorts of things.
Wow. Folks, our guest, we're so lucky to have him, Raymond Ibrahim. His website, of course, of the same name, RaymondIbrahim.com.
And that's Raymond, I-B-R-A-H-I-M.
Right.
I-B-R-A-H-I-M.
I mean, he is the go-to man. He's the expert on Islamic affairs, terrorism, and such. I mean,
Yeah, and when we come back, we're going to pick up right where we left off because I think it's real important that we go over some of this history. And, you know, today we hear how Israel, you know, is stealing land. They stole the land. They're a country that shouldn't be there. And when you hear the history of this, as Mr. Ibrahim just said, that two-thirds of the Muslim world is on stolen territory. If we're going to look at history as our guideline. And that's a very interesting fact, and we're going to expand on that when we come back after these short messages. Stay with us.